You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are excited to bring you an author chat with Susan Lee to talk about her latest novel, The Romance Rivalry, a rom-com about two rival booktubers who enter a competition with each other to find out who will find love first in college, using nothing but romance tropes. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as a Patreon supporter, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server to chat with us and fellow book club members in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the ability to help us pick a patron's choice book club pick once every quarter.
Yeah, so Susan Lee is part of the Kim Chingus, and we finally have another one under our belt. So it was really nice to get Susan to be on the show with us. And, you know, we talk about romance tropes. We talk about having Korean-American immigrant expectations, about, like, the publishing industry and how gender norms are a thing in the book reviewer sphere. Lots of fun topics that we cover in this conversation.
Yeah, so please enjoy our author chat with Susan Lee.
And we are here with Susan Lee, the author of Soulmates and The Name Drop. And we're here to talk about her latest book, The Romance Rivalry. Welcome to the show, Susan. We've wanted you for so long, so I'm so glad it's finally happened. I feel like I've been to all of your book events, and it's just, this is the first time we're having you.
I know, and I am a longtime listener. I'm a big fan of you guys. I always feel bad that Martin's going to get dragged into this romance conversation.
Oh, it's fine. I am.
We'll talk about gender norms in like the romance review sphere. Because I think it is like a very nuanced conversation. But before we dive into things, so Susan and I are very big BTS fans. We are ARMYs. And it's a very exciting time for us because BTS is coming back next month. And yeah. And even though it's been a group hiatus, every member has had like their solo promotions and tours. So my question to you, Susan, is like, did you have a favorite solo from chapter two?
Gosh, you know, it's so funny because like I've had this conversation with fellow ARMY about, you know, what is the role of ARMY during chapter two? And if we're obligated to like love everything. And I'm to be honest, I'm not a huge solo fan. I do love August D. I went and saw all of Yoongi's concerts. I wasn't an August D fan before I went and saw him live. So for me, that was really some of the most emotional stuff. I love Namjoon's stuff too, but it's not the kind of stuff that I would just listen to over and over again. You know, and JK and Jimin, they have bops, but I'm not a huge, just deep fan of any of them solo, though I've gone and seen all of them live solo. So I feel like it's been more kind of my ARMY heart that has led me there to see them. But truthfully, I am just stoked for them to get back together and have grown musically. And yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah, I mean, like throughout chapter two, it's been like, sometimes I forget that they're like a group because their music is so different as soloists. And I'm like, wow, like imagine if these people were in a group together. And it's like, they are in a group together. And it is like really funny that you mentioned like the August D concert, because I feel like you and I were at some of those concerts, like at the same time. And it was like very emotional.
Yeah. Also because I feel like he was, in my mind, Yoongi to me was the least likely. I just was so surprised that he was the one that was going to do a solo world tour. I just never read him that way, but he was so good. Like he just was so earnest, and like it was it was just an emotional time. And I think I saw him 4 times, and it just each one got better. And I think this also just speaks to their talent and their love of music that a lot of groups don't have at this depth, where they can all be solo, be so different, and yet come together and create what is BTS. I mean, I think it's just a big kudos to how talented they are.
Yeah. Sorry for going on a BTS tangent, but I thought it was like very important because you put BTS in your acknowledgments for every one of your books. So obviously they're a very big part of like your writer's journey.
Yeah. I have nothing to add to this conversation, but I'm happy for you too that you'll be getting your group back.
Yay. Thanks. We appreciate that.
Are you going to Jin, by the way?
Yeah, I am going to Jin. And I also meant to tell you, I'm also going to Enhypen in LA.
Oh, yeah. Yay.
This could be my first Enhypen concert. So I'm excited.
I won't be there because I'm going to my third and final wedding reception. But Enhypen, they're my vampire babies. I love them. They're going to be so great. They're going to take care of you. All right. Moving on to book stuff. I want to start off by saying congratulations on becoming a USA Today bestseller for The Romance Rivalry. That's such a big accomplishment. Well deserved.
Oh, thank you so much. It was I just found out this morning. I was truly, truly. I know. I think authors say this a lot, but I swear that this is honest. I just never expected it. So, and I think that some people, you know, will whisper in your ear. And the reason I just never expected is because this book didn't have any really publisher support. And so we always have the conversation. There's only so much that an author can do. There's this huge conversation happening right now on Threads about moving the needle and what we're capable of doing. And when you rely on an author's efforts, you are counting sales in ones and maybe tens. A publisher can move sales in thousands. And so if you don't have that kind of support, it's like, I just thought that this was impossible for this book, but I was going to do the best that I could to put myself in the best position I could to be stronger for my next books, you know? And so, yeah, this morning's news was quite a surprise. And I was just, I'm so grateful that, that readers showed up for this book.
Yeah, congratulations. So we like to start off our author chats by learning more about our author's, you know, journey to becoming a published author, because, you know, there are so many different ways, different avenues, different pathways that, you know, especially Asian American authors can take. And, you know, your story is one that takes you through a career change, right? A different path. So we'd love to hear more about how you, you know, got started writing and how you became the author you are today.
And I just wanted to interject, like, I know that you used to be like a corporate girly and you weren't that much of a reader either. I was pretty surprised to learn that. So I would love to hear more about like how you became a reader as well on top of being a writer.
You know, like, I think one of the things that it's kind of my soapbox that I like to just preach and advice I like to give is that we have to be kinder to ourselves when we want to pivot in our life. And that's not something, especially as Asians, that we are allotted or allowed. You know, it's like a lot of times we're kind of told what the expectations are. We then try to make choices within those expectations. And then, you know, we're often raised not to be rebel rousers, make any like, you know, make waves, just put your head down, do the work. And that includes like leaving jobs or moving and trying new careers. And so, but I am that classic, you know, Asian kid who went to UCSD Ravel. I thought I was studying biochem. I thought I was going to be a doctor. And my fourth year of college, I thought I'm not going to get into med school. And then my only choices are going to work in a lab. And I just could not see myself doing that. So my fifth year, I stayed an extra year and flipped my minor, which was history, to my major and graduated. And you know, there's nothing you can do with a history degree. So I found a job on Craigslist and became like an admin assistant at a real estate office. And I was kind of the one that was learning how to use all the computers and fixing the printers and all that stuff. And eventually they sent me to school and I learned to be a network engineer. And for a while, that was my job in my early 20s, learning how to work within Microsoft and Cisco systems. And then in that, I just started training people, and training led to another Craigslist job. It was an admin assistant for an HR administrative assistant. And I started learning kind of the back channels of HR, human resources, and just not just like systems and admin and payroll and benefits, but kind of like being that person that people come to, not just to ask questions, but like to release frustrations and to navigate the workplace. And so that my career kind of took off from there. When I got into HR, I really just went up the corporate ladder, found myself within the startup space. And then I became kind of more senior level HR for startups like Spotify. I became the head of HR at Warby Parker. And then eventually made it into the C-suite of human resources and doing executive work. And look, I thought for a long time that I loved that career. I thought for a long time that I was one of those people that was impacting change within organizations. And then COVID hit. And then I'll kind of tell you my shift in my career first and then tell you where kind of reading and writing came into all of that. But when COVID hit, I had moved and taken a job over out here in LA. And you know, those conversations about can people work from home, and how do we help people who are homeschooling their kids and still have to work all day? And can we give people support for, emotional and mental health and online therapy? And how do we like really just take care of people? And this was also around the time when George Floyd incident happened, the murder of George Floyd, and people were very much hurting. And when you're in the executive space and you're having these conversations, inevitably, like the conversation of cost comes into play and business. And it started really just impacting me that we weren't doing better by humans, by just human nature. And so I was very much struggling with what I was doing in my life. At that same time, I had started writing my first book and I had entered some online mentoring programs, and I'd done the whole querying and all this stuff, and my book was out on Sub. And I had decided that if I could get an out, I was going to get out. And when I finally sold my book, it was Soulmates. Soulmates was my second book that we went on Sub with. But when I finally sold that, I decided that I would give up everything. I would give up the career, the title, the money. I would give up the possibility of the future that I built for buying a house, having a nice car. And I would move home and live with my mother, and I would preserve my mental health and my emotional and physical health. And I would write books about Korean American people falling in love. And I did not know at the time, but what I've come to found is it is way more impactful for me to be writing these books and to the message and kind of the support that I want to give to humanity is much more powerful in writing these books than it ever was than working in corporate America. So yeah, I just kind of redefined success, what success meant for me. And I'm healthier, happier. And yeah, now I'm doing this.
Yeah. I will say, as someone who did study like business, when you realize that the whole point of what you do is to just to make everything into, everything becomes a cost. Everyone becomes like numbers, and it, the ultimate goal is to spend as little as possible, but get as much out of as possible. And just like fundamentally, it's just exploitation is the name of like business, right?
Yeah. Yes. And it's, I mean, obviously it's so worse now in this day and age. And I can't even imagine people who are working in HR or DEI. And, you know, now that's a bad word. And I mean, it, you know, at that point in that time, we were trying to be better. All corporations were trying to be better during this time. And the way that in just a few years that can completely flip on its head, it's an unsafe environment, I think, emotionally. I just feel really bad for people who are kind of put in these positions to do it. I'm like, thank God I'm out.
I know. I will say, even like your story about finding your first job through Craigslist. Like, remember when we used to be able to find legitimate actual jobs on like just
yeah,
on
now it's like all AI or like fake listings. It's rough out there, you guys.
Or like 10 rounds of interviews and you don't even get the job, right?
And negotiating yeah. for like $3,000 extra in your salary when like a white man was going to get an extra $20,000 because he's just louder about it. It's like just stuff like that I just didn't want to be the mouthpiece for that anymore. So,
well, congratulations on escaping the rat race.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm just really lucky because as Ria had said, I was not an early reader, but I was kind of like a free spirit in that like I moved around a lot. I started new careers multiple times in my life. And in those, I was kind of starting from scratch and usually without knowing a lot of people in town or whatever. And it wasn't until, you know, my adult life that I kind of stumbled on what used to be called chick lit, now kind of known as women's fiction, and eventually led into romance. And those became just kind of like a really great time for me to just like pass loneliness and also just figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And that kind of led to me being able to write a book. It was really Gloria Chow's American Panda was one of the first YA books that I thought, oh, you know, actually I might want to write for teens and not through a white lens, but through a lens of someone who's kind of navigating being, you know, growing up in an immigrant family here in the States. So, yeah, that's how I kind of found my way here.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, what was it about YA that, like, you know, you're like, oh, I want to give this a try. I know you have an adult romance novel that's coming out, but, you know, the first three books that you've written are YA. So why was this demographic interesting to you?
You know, I actually don't read a lot of YA, which is, you know, a lot of people tell you you should really read very broadly in what you write. I think two things. I am kind of, this sounds ridiculous, but I feel sometimes in my soul that I was made to be a defender of people with the voiceless, and the way that like sometimes in publishing, the gatekeepers of children's lit, especially for teenagers, the people, I call them the pearl clutchers, are the ones that just get really like feel strongly about what teens are allowed to read and what not. And you know, and with book banning, all that stuff. Well, back when I started, it was just like, I just felt that like, I was working in technology and startups. We were like recruiting kids straight out of high school. You didn't even have to go to college. You know, we needed engineers. And when I would meet these 18-year-olds and I'm just like, this is not how you're represented in media. You know, like the deep choices that they're asked to make at that age. And so I just wanted to kind of write about young people where they were empowered and had agency to make choices for themselves. And the second thing is, and this might be going real deep and you guys could edit this if you want, but I grew up in the church and I was like a youth group leader and, you know, a Bible study teacher. And I think that I really believe that I taught some problematic things for kids that actually kind of messed up their, I just taught them a lot of no's of what they're not allowed to do in life. And I think at that time I was really a firm believer that that was the case. And sometimes I feel like writing YA is my penance of like, you know, like changing that message so that I'm like, this is nothing anti-church or anything, but I was just so rigid about things and made, I think, especially young girls feel so badly about things that they thought and believed and were going through. And like a part of me just feels like I have to do right. This is another chance to do right by young people. And giving an opportunity for them to kind of have a different message out there for them.
As someone who was also very big in the church community, I totally understand what you mean by, like, I feel like a lot of the things that we were taught was not healthy, especially towards girls. So, like, I definitely understand. So I wanted to ask you, since we are here to talk about the romance rivalry, can you give us a short elevator pitch for people who have not heard of your book yet?
Sure. The Romance Rivalry is about two rival romance book reviewers online, Irene. She's kind of the original. She's really big in the space. She has a huge following. And it is the one thing that she finds identity in. She's a middle child. Her siblings are all kind of outstanding. This is her thing. And then this rival male romance book reviewer comes onto the scene, and he gets it a lot easier. He has followers that come, you know, quicker and kind of given more of a pass in a lot of ways. And they find themselves at the same school and enter into a competition to see who's going to find love first using romance tropes. And the winner wins kind of like a brand like deal that content creators that they were both going after. And then the loser has to erase themselves from the internet. And spoiler alert, they fall in love. And yeah, so it's kind of a fun take on tropes, fun take on the conversation of romance in our society today, and kind of the newer introduction of males reading romance and as fans instead of as critics. And yeah, I just kind of wanted to touch on a lot of those things.
I will say, as someone who is in the bookfluencer adjacent space, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it was very like meta. So it was like a very interesting experience. I wonder what other like booktubers and bookstagrammers think about that. But one of the things that,
have you gotten any like booktubers say like feel called out?
Yeah, not directly, but honestly, what's funny is like I'm just such a fan, actually, of booktubers and bookstagrammers and booktalkers. I follow so many. I'm like, oddly, it's funny when you're first starting off as a writer, you have like all these other authors that you're fans of. And I'm like, oh, I'm fans of like editors and reviewers. I'm like kind of odd that way. And I have handfuls that I love watching. And so they really kind of inspired the story, like people who can just put out there how much they love or hate or felt a certain way about a book. I admire that so much. And so they were kind of the inspiration. And I haven't had anyone say, oh, you totally failed in representing me. But of course, I took a lot of creative liberties too. So
I also wonder how many like kids these days do go about, because, you know, romance genres has seen a resurgence, right? It's like gotten super popular, especially in booktuber, bookfluencer circles. I wonder how many kids actually do go about their love life using romance fiction as like a guide.
God, I would hope not many, but
it does sound frightening.
I would not recommend, but I did love how each of your chapters was named after a trope, and it kind of revolved around that specific trope. I was a little bit confused when Secret Baby came up, and I was like, what? Like, is someone pregnant that I like that I didn't like, what is this? And yeah, I was like, what is happening?
It was a figure of Secret Baby for our listeners who are like wondering.
Yeah, there's no actual Secret Baby, but like, did you come up with the tropes after you wrote the chapters, or did you like say, okay, this is a trope, I'm going to write my chapter around this?
Yeah, I mean, I did the latter. So basically, I'm not a plotter by any means. So when I knew I wanted to kind of follow this format, I had created a list of tropes. And what's funny is when you like Google romance tropes, like there are a lot of, misunderstandings of what a trope actually is. So I just had worked to figure out what are some of my favorites, or some even ones that I don't usually read or whatever. I just wanted a long list. And then as I was writing the story, after each chapter, I thought, okay, where could I go next? And which trope could help me would lead me there? So like for the Secret Baby one, I knew I wanted to, it was around that time where they needed to hit their misunderstanding, you know, their third act breakup. And I thought, you know, what's the one that can like throw everything on its head? And so that's how I pulled that one in. But I mean, really the use of tropes is, a lot of the things that I do in this book are not necessarily subversions, but they are kind of like nods to like, you know, discourse online, where people like, especially a lot of newer romance readers are like, oh, tropes are so overdone, they're so tired. And I wanted to just show that like tropes are not, I mean, they're all over romance. You're not going to get rid of them. It's like, that's kind of what builds the story in these books. And so I would rather lean into stuff like that than, yeah. So I just kind of like stole a lot of discourse and conversation so that I could kind of lean in and kind of give my point of view about that.
I think it's because like the reason why romance tropes are so popular when it comes to like marketing, I think it's because romance is considered like a safe haven. Like it's like, you know, people, it can be like brain candy or it can just be like an escape. And you read romance novels because of the HEAs, the happily ever afters. So people like going in with the expectation that things are going to be okay and things are going to be familiar. So that's why I think tropes are so heavily marketed. And people who say, like, this book is just tropes, it doesn't have any stories to it, I'm like, I don't think that's true. Like,
yeah, I mean, tropes are just basically like kind of like a backyard gate. And then everything that happens within that yard, like that's what's in the book. So just because it gives you kind of, you know, familiar parameters, it doesn't mean that what's happening in that backyard is not fresh and fun. And so.
Yeah. Irene in your book says, I hate enemies to lovers. Like that's a trope that she does not like, but it's super popular in online spaces. So are you a big fan of enemies to lovers?
I love enemies to lovers. I mean, truly, I'm more of a rivals to lovers because I love that there has to be kind of a forced interaction in rivals. And, you know, a lot of people say that enemies to lovers, people who write enemies to lovers, they're actually, a lot of people don't even, they're not actually really enemies. I am not that picky. I do like enemies to lovers. I love tension and conflict. So I have not yet written one that's a true enemies to lovers. And I think sometimes I'm just like, too apologetic. I don't want them to, I don't want them to hurt each other's feelings. So, I do like to read it. Yeah. Again, that was her take on enemies to lovers was again, kind of like trying to push the conversation and discourse. Cause I see people who like love it so much, you know? And so, yeah, but, I am a big fan.
I feel like enemies lovers, usually it's like, it's the perception of enmity, right? It's like always one person hates the other person, but more often than not, even like in the OG, like Pride and Prejudice, like Darcy was always in love with Lizzie, right? Yeah. Like, so like, it wasn't actually mutual enmity. It was like, just like, she just hates his guts.
It's a lot of it is just notice. Misunderstanding, miscommunication. I mean, true enemies to lovers. Like there's this, I remember reading last year, The Jacid Heir. It's a fantasy book by Sarah Hesham. And like they were, you know, kind of like sworn to kill each other. Their kingdoms were enemies and they multiple times tried to kill each other. And I'm like, I see. Yeah, this is it. This is enemies to lovers. It's like, number one, I wish you dead. Number two, I wish you in my bed. It's like the first is dead, two in my bed. So
that's a t-shirt.
That felt good. So I was like, that feels like enemies. But you don't really see that too often.
Especially in contemporary.
Yeah, you know?
Like if you're actually going to murder someone, then that's kind of like a spy thriller kind of
it
thing.
It is hard. Yeah, agreed.
Marvin brought up Pride and Prejudice, and I wanted to mention Austin because you find out, this isn't really a spoiler because I feel like it's brought up like early enough, but Irene has never read an Austin novel. And I wish when I was like reading this book, I sent you voice notes, Susan, because like, I had like visceral reactions to a lot of like plot points. And I was like, oh, she's never read an Austin book, not a single one. And she calls herself a romance author. And like she jokes about it in the book as well, being like, if the romance community found out, they would crucify me. And I'm like, absolutely. Like, what? Was that something that you always planned to have for her character?
Okay, well, the joke is I have read, I mean, because I've been to school, so I've been assigned it. I don't enjoy Austin books. And I always used to think that I just couldn't, I didn't get them, you know, like I thought I didn't get them. And I'm also just a pretty lazy reader. I also have sometimes trouble reading fantasy. Like I'm not great at focusing on world building or focusing on text that feels different than a contemporary speech. So I have always struggled with Austin, except for movies. Like I love, you know, obviously Pride and Prejudice from the movies. And So, and I've been made fun of many a time. I've been told that I need to try again. And so I did kind of want, that was like a little, like, a little nod to those of us who are not Austinites, you know, in our lives, but still can appreciate what Austin brings to the genre.
I think the importance is the respect to the OG.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have the feeling that the vast majority of people who love Pride and Prejudice have only seen like the Joel Wright 2005
yes.
version.
No, that is not true. That is absolutely not true, because there have been so many modern adaptations. So there's the Lizzie Bennett Diaries. There's the Bridget Jones Diaries. There's Pride and Prejudice Zombies. There's like Bride and Prejudice. There's so many different versions.
Which was my first Pride and Prejudice. That's like, you know how, you know, your first Pride and Prejudice is like the one that defines you. Mine was the zombies one.
Oh, see.
I remember the book. Did like the book got like really popular, and ironically, like I never picked it up because I was like, oh, this seems kind of like a cash grab, and it kind of was. And in the end,
but I will say that this probably get me in trouble, but I feel like it did the confession scene better than the Joel Wright version.
Okay, all right. Well, you've never read Pride and Prejudice, so okay, we're gonna move on. But like with differing opinions and banter, Aiden and Irene, they are rivals because they review the same books, and usually they have differing opinions. And I thought it was so funny that in between these chapters, you would have like epigraphs from like their reviews and how like they would clash. What was it like when you were coming up with their respective reviews on specific tropes and books?
Truly, that was the hardest part of writing this book. So, I used to be, before I was a writer, and even though I was kind of late in life reader, when I started reading, I kind of just went down the rabbit hole. I was reading like over 200 romance books a year. I was a big, like when I went in, I went in hard, and I started reviewing them online kind of when Goodreads was just coming up. I was like a top 10 reviewer in the world for Goodreads. Like they used to rank reviewers based on how many, like how much interaction you had and stuff. And I had a blog on blogspot.com. And I mean, it was like old school days before people did videos of reviews. And I always found, like, literally my reviews were so ridiculous. It was like, oh my God, exclamation point. I love this. You know, he was so hot. I mean, like literally no substance to these reviews at all. It was just, you had to meet like a character limit to be able to post. And so like, I would just have like 100 exclamation points if I liked a book. And then I'd be like 4.5 stars, you know? And so I was so terrible at it. And I watch so many now, and that's why, like I said, I have so much respect for people who are able to summarize the book, summarize without giving spoilers, summarize their thoughts on a book, summarize, you know, kind of like their, what they think the author was trying to do. And I just don't have that gift. So then deciding to write these like little snippets of reviews in a way that kind of gives you a hint of what's going to happen in the next chapter and gives you an insight to both of these characters and how they're feeling at the time was like brutal. It was excruciating. It was probably the parts that I had to edit the most and change the most throughout the editing process. And they're literally just like four lines. Like I really struggled with that, to be honest. But I've had really the most kind of positive reaction to those epigraphs the most. Like people just kind of love it. And the one that's quoted the most is Aiden says about fake dating. He's like, his hot take is that one of the people involved has fallen even before fake dating has begun. And I don't even remember writing that, but that has been quoted so many times to me. And I'm just like, wow, that sounds really smart. I have no idea like, where that came from.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I really like about also the fact that your main couple are two rival booktubers is that, you know, it goes to show that two people can read the same thing and have different viewpoints, and that's okay. And that's something that, you know, your main character Irene has to come to terms with, is like, it's okay to have differing viewpoints. Not everything is, because someone disagrees, is not an attack on your own.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And so much like this is, I mean, people feel very strongly, obviously, about the books they read, and especially in the romance genre. But like also we could have differing opinions, but you could also have differing opinions depending on when you read it. Like, it could be totally about what you're going through in your life at that moment. And I also tried to show that, like, when Irene was opening more up to love in her own life, she was changing in her. They started actually agreeing towards the end in some reviews. And so, like, you know, reading and reviewing, it's vibes, you know, and like, that's
it really
not,
is
yeah.
Vibes,
and so
yeah.
We have to, I think, have more grace towards each other for what we like and don't like. And that has nothing to do with anyone else but you. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Marvin and I butt heads quite often on the show when it comes to like our own opinions on books. But a lot of the times we do agree. So,
yeah, you know, I have stronger opinions, less about what I think of a book, but more about why I think a book has gotten popular, or like why I think a book has taken off or gotten viral. Like, I have stronger opinions or questions or willing to debate that kind of stuff than I am necessarily my take on a book.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Irene obviously feels very strongly about any attack on her, you know, her profession, because it's like you mentioned, it's kind of her identity. It's like what she can lay her claim to. And I thought it was very diabolical of you to, like, usually, you know, stories like this, there's like a sibling or there's like a cousin who's like number one in their class, valedictorian. But you went above and beyond. You made a family full of prodigies that she is the middle child of. Like, her older sister is like a model or like a fashion influencer, and her younger brother is like a golf prodigy. And so, like, it's already hard enough to feel adequate as a middle child. But now you also add in like these two, you're surrounded by people who are like really good at what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. And also Aiden, his brother's a doctor. So it's like, it's kind of a rinse and repeat in my books, but I do like kind of playing with the expectation and identity on immigrant kids. And, you know, it's like, I always, in all my books, there is the conversation of how their parents want them to be a doctor, because it's just what I've lived with my whole life. And that never seems to change generation to generation, which just blows my mind. And then adding on to it now, it's like, okay, maybe the next generation of parents are more progressive. Like, you don't have to be a doctor, but they just want you to be the best at something. But something that they understand or can brag about to their friends, you know, or to their aunts and uncles and stuff. And so I wanted to have a space where the discussion can be that, you know, Irene can be amazing at something and her parents don't understand it. So it lacks that feeling of success in her mind, until they kind of have the conversation about, you know, like, the parents really just want her to be happy and that's successful. That really stems from when I was talking about how I changed my career and my life. When this was all happening before, when I was still kind of an executive in corporate America, my father had passed. And when I had decided to change everything and become a writer, my thought to myself was, if my dad was alive, he never would have accepted this. But the way that he lived his life was what gave me the courage to do it. Like, he was the one too. He was an engineer in Korea, and he came to America and he became a mechanic. And then he fixed typewriters, and like that kind of experience, how he lived his life, told me that I can make choices for survival, success, happiness, that might not have been what I originally planned. So he gave me that. But he is also an immigrant father who would have hated that I was technically unemployed and came home to live with my family, you know? So, but I wanted to play with that kind of that dichotomy, and for Irene too, and for Aiden, and just, expectations and what success looks like in successful families.
Yeah, and they definitely go through imposter syndrome, and I thought you depicted that really well. It's funny how, like, Irene, she has two siblings who are, like, extraordinary at what they do in their fields, but she's also extraordinary. She has a million followers on BookTube, and I'm like, it's so hard to get a million followers. Yeah, in, like, a niche field, as someone who runs, like, an Asian American book podcast, it is, like, so hard, you guys, to like garner that level of, audience and loyalty and dedication. And I'm like, What are you talking about? What do you mean you're mediocre? Like,
yeah, yeah. You know what's interesting? When I was kind of picking that number, what was going to be the follower number? I wanted it to be because I, you know, like I said, I follow a lot of people at different varying, you know, stages in their online life. And I've seen some with like 20,000 or less, some that are like in the hundreds of thousands. I've seen very few with the millions. And so I was originally worried that that was going to be a little bit of a turnoff to people because there are so few of them, but it was important to me that it was like, she is the best at what she's doing and known as the best, but she doesn't necessarily know how to see herself that way. And, I needed kind of like that level of very few people get there, you know, and very few people can get there. So I wanted there to be something at risk for her at that level. So that's kind of why I shot so high.
Yeah. I mean, I like from the get-go when she was like, oh, I reached a million followers. I'm like, you are an unreliable narrator.
Yeah, no,
like,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like, I also appreciated how you showed like Irene struggling with her college courses. And I feel like there's a stereotype that all Asians are like so serious about their studies. They put so much pressure on themselves because, you know, immigrant parents, you know, kind of pass on that expectations onto you. But Irene, even though she puts a lot of pressure on herself because, you know, she's going to her dad's, you know, college and she's trying to like fulfill the dream that her mom thinks is best for her interests, so to become a book editor. And Irene is just like, I'm struggling so hard, but I just have to like keep faking it and maybe I'll get out of it. And I was like, oh, I don't really see this. I don't really see a failing Asian in college in books. So how did you like develop her arc?
Well, college is like so... it's so different. It's like the amount of freedom that you have, like no one's watching you to make sure you're studying. And, you know, we grew up and my parents used to be like, you have to practice the piano for an hour, then you have to go study. And like, then you have to go to Hagwon after. And it's like, there was so much expectation to get to a place. And then when you get to college and you're living on your own and like everything is self-motivated. And like, I struggled in college, you know, it's like, because I am the type that I'm like, what's the minimal effort I can give for the maximum output? So it's like, if I don't have to go to class every day, but I still get the syllabus and can just write a paper at the end, like, why go? Like, that was kind of it was like a very new experience for me. And I wanted to explore that. Like, you know, we now have our own choices. We're in charge of our own schedules and how much effort we put in. And she kept kind of knowing there was a problem, but putting off dealing with it until she was then really screwed, you know, and in a bad situation and where other people were noticing. So I thought, like, I don't always see in college, books set in college, that question of what do I do when all the choices and time management, everything are on my shoulders and nobody cares if I don't go, nobody cares if I do go, you know? And so, yeah, so it's a little bit, you know, like a memoir of my college life, but I feel like a lot of people kind of struggle with that when they first get to school.
Yeah, I will say I definitely felt seen because I too, like Irene, made the mistake of picking 8 a.m. class my very first quarter in college.
Oh my God. I like was side-eyeing so hard.
It's hilarious.
Like I said,
we're
like,
oh, we go to high school
took voice notes while I was reading this book because when I read that she had 8 a.m. classes, I'm like, girl, what? Like, what are you doing to yourself?
You know, the logic is sound, right? I woke up 8 a.m. every day for high school. I could totally do this.
Exactly.
Not knowing that, like, you're going to be, you know, hanging out with friends all night and, you know, doing college stuff. And then, you know, the result of that is I torched my GPA for like the first 3 years of college.
Yeah. Or like I was a biochem major and I hated every single one of my classes. And, you know, it's like my nephew, he's graduating high school. He's about to go to school. And like I told him, Michael, my one bit of advice for your freshman year is don't look at it like high school. Don't schedule yourself for 8 a.m. classes. You know, give yourself, don't feel like you have to take, oh, you know, I took 5 or 6 classes in high school, so I'll take 5 or 6 classes my first semester in college. Like, no, you don't have to. You don't have to put that struggle on yourself. Like, give yourself time and space to also acclimate to, you know, a new lifestyle. So, but I'm glad you noticed that because I was like wondering, like, who would notice the foolish choice of an 8 a.m. class. Who fell down that, you know, did that same trap when they were in college?
Also, don't stack all your classes on one day on the same day for the 4-day weekend until you're confident that you can get by.
That's with exactly. Classes. Yes. Yeah. It's so funny, those choices, those early choices.
Yeah. I also thought it was really funny that, you know, Irene, as someone who like loves to read, she almost only reads romance. Like, she does not read any other genre. And that's why she is struggling so much in like her literature classes, even though like contemporary literature is her major. And I was like, how funny is that? That like, just because you like to read doesn't mean that you are suited to be a writer or an editor. Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily mean you're well-read, if that makes sense either. Like, you know, it's like, I think you, like, there are some readers who know their comfort zone and that's fine. And some who love to challenge themselves. I mean, I read, I would say probably 80% romance. But I also know that, like, I read, kind of like Irene figures out, I read for vibes, I read for comfort, I read for distraction. So I have no shame in my romance reading game, but I also know that it's like, I'm not looking to like change the way I see the world just by, you know, reading romance novels. So I think sometimes we definitely limit ourselves when we don't kind of expand our horizons, but it's totally okay too, if that's all you want to consume, you know, so.
I have to confess. So like Aiden, you know, he is like, he reviews romance novels like almost exclusively as well. And, you know, he also gets almost 1 million followers in a much shorter time frame than Irene, because he is a conventionally good looking guy. And his handle is like Aiden Reads Romance, or Guy Who Reads Romance. I forgot what his actual handle was, but soon as I read that, I was like, I fucking hate him. Like, he doesn't know how hard it is to be a bookfluencer, and he is just using his male privilege, because just the bar is on the floor, because God forbid if a guy reads Pride and Prejudice once and says he likes it, he's like God in the literary world.
And honestly, like, he doesn't really realize that either. He doesn't realize his privilege. And which made me pissed, a little bit more pissed off at him. It's like, but you know what's funny? Like, I was writing this and I had been almost finished. And then I remember on Book Talk, there was this guy, his name is Zach. He was this good looking guy. He had a beard. Anyways, he was new to Book Talk. And I remember he showed up. I mean, I'm guessing he probably read ACOTAR or something, how they all find their way into it. And he literally in one night had 100,000 followers. And I remember, like, the comments of women would say things. It would be a smattering of some, like, oh, like, you know, that's not fair, you know, whatever. But then there would be others totally objectifying him. And even though I had already started writing this book, it was so timely, because I'm like, oh, it validated how I thought this would play out for a guy like that. And right now there's some dude, I guess he was like on The Bachelor Australia, and he just shows up to Book Talk recently. He's like this lumber sexual guy. Like, and all of a sudden it's also the new kind of conversation of how, like, yeah, like women are sending him books on his Amazon wish list and just shit like that. And so it's like, I was like, okay, I feel validated in how I thought it would happen. It exactly plays out that way for some people. So.
Yeah. And it's also like, since Book Talk and Bookstagram, it's, you know, mainly women. It's like, there's like also this expectation for them to do like, to be like beauty gurus as well. And like, do like, get ready with me while I talk about these books. Like, it kind of seems like they're forced into these boxes of like, okay, how do I make myself as pleasing to the consumer? Because that's pretty much what it is. And it reminded me of how, like, the industry kind of views romance. Like, they don't consider it as like a serious genre. It's just for women. And it's like, but it's like the most heavily consumed genre in the industry. It brings so much money. Like, so just like, they are subsidizing literary fiction with the sales of romance fiction. And I just thought that was like an interesting parallel that you kind of showed in your book.
Well, I mean, so much of, well, the world, but like publishing and content creator space, there's just so much misogyny. And, it's a hard time being a woman, you know. It's I feel like I wanted to bring some light to that, at least make a nod to the kinds of things that women have to do that men don't have that same expectation. And you know what, though? Like, shame on me, too, because I don't think I always recognize my own kind of internal misogyny. But, like, even at my events recently, like, I've had men there, and not even just boyfriends or fathers, you know, like, readers. Like, some guy came up to me and said that he had the name drop with him, and he said, this book got me back into reading. And I was like, my jaw was on the ground. And I'm like, why am I also so shocked about, why do I put us in these boxes, male, female, you know, non-binary, but like also just like only this person, it makes sense for you to read romance, and this person is surprising, or this person, the expectation that you have to be pretty and read romance. And like, you know, it's like I fall victim to that too. Into that trap. And I just think society, we have to, you know, we have to be better. And I like when people surprise me. I like when we get surprises of challenging those, you know, existing norms.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to just the why we need diverse stories, diverse books, why we need representation. Because, you know, I for one was happy that as a 6 foot tall Asian dude, I got 6 foot tall Asian dude representation in your story as a love interest. I was
love
very
it.
Excited about that. And, you know, not to defend the guy, but, you know, he turns out to be okay, dude.
Yeah, he's
and
a good kid.
The fact that, like, you know, during those epigraphs, I was like, I'm vibing with like his take on these tropes, and I would watch his channel if he existed in real life.
I'm so grateful you said that, because honestly, I love writing a male point of view. I think that, like, I kind of grew up a tomboy. I've always had kind of surrounded myself with guys as I was growing up. And I, especially in romance, want to see guys love reading romance. And so I hope that I can, like, when I write male points of view, that they don't sound like women writing men. Although I know they're very idealistic, you know, guys, and, you know, they're definitely romance heroes, you know, but like, yeah, that was very, that's cool to hear. Thanks.
Yeah, it's definitely the idealized, like, romance, romantic lead, because I'm pretty sure I don't smell as good as what Irene smells on him.
I want to get this out of the way. So Aiden on the cover of your book, that's Subin,
that's
right?
Subin, yeah.
From TXT with glasses.
Yeah, even like, so what I tend to do, I don't really see my characters when I'm writing them, but I also don't describe well. So when I go back through edits, I try to think of who kind of they're not inspired by, but who kind of has that same heart of like this character. And when I think of just like cinnamon roll, sweet, but also just like playful people, like Subin is one of the first people that comes to mind. So I described this guy as having dimples and a long neck, and it, like, that was very Subin, you know, coded there. And then when we were doing the cover art, they asked who, you know, who my inspirations were visually, and I gave them pictures of Subin and Chaewon from Le Sserafim. So,
I mean, it's so funny, the timing of this book, because TXT just did a comeback, and it's called Love Language. You guys can look it up on YouTube. And during the dance break, or like during like the chorus, Subin has like his solo moment, and he has these glasses. He puts on these glasses that look exactly like the glasses that Aiden wears on the cover of your book.
Yes. And then he does, like, he shows his abs, which I'm just like, Subin.
It was nasty.
You took a break. Disgusting. And came back. You came back like a grown up. I'm not ready for this. Actually, I wasn't ready even when like Bumgoo got all buff. I'm like, what? These are just, I think of them as like little brothers.
I think of them as like my sons. So yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. But like, that was kind of perfect timing with the glasses. I'm like, okay.
It's like great marketing time. You know, someone make a reel. okay, well, we are winding down to the end of our time. I mean, it just flew by. So I mentioned earlier that your adult romance novel is coming soon. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. It's called Julia's Song is Undateable. It comes out October 28th. And it is, you know, it's kind of just the adult version of what I write in YA. It's two Korean-American neighbors. And Julia Song is the CEO of a K-beauty company that she founded. She's great at business, but terrible at love. She has had failed dates all throughout her life. And her parents come at her and say, we really, you just turned 30 and we'd like to see you get married. So she agrees to let them set her up on 3 dates. But because she's so bad at dates and really bad at dates with Korean men, she asks her neighbor if he can help her like practice dating before each of these. It is, it's probably the most Korean American book I've written. Like there are just tons of inside jokes. And it's not just about Korean Americans, but immigrant families and how they're so bonkers. And sometimes you just can't even believe the things that come out of their mouths. And then also our own expectations on ourselves and redefining success and girlfriendships, finding someone who loves you exactly as you are. You don't have to change for them. And set in Orange County, it's set in Irvine. And so it is probably my favorite thing I've ever written. I love it. I think it's super wacky and funny, but also really heartfelt. And family dynamics are lovely in this book. So yeah, I hope everyone will give it a try.
Yeah. Again, I'm not Korean, but as someone who was also a late bloomer, started dating earnestly in my 30s. I feel like you have your hand on the pulse right here on my life. So
yeah, it sounds like something that is going to just be super fun to read once it comes out.
I really hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my God. This is the best time. I'm so glad.
Fun time talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And that was Susan Lee. Her latest novel, The Romance Rivalry, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Bubble Bookshop. And any purchase you make on our online bookstore, support not only us at the Books and Bubble podcast, but also your local bookstores. So if our conversation has made you interested in picking up Susan's book, head on over to booksandbubble.com and check out our bookshop link. And before we go, just a quick reminder that our June 2025 book club pick is After Parties, a short story collection by Anthony Biasna. So as always, we look forward to reading along with our members. So if you are a Patreon supporter, be sure to check out the Books and Bubble Discord to find our reading schedule. And for those of you who aren't Patreon supporters, you can still let us know your thoughts about the book by going to our Goodreads forums and leaving your feedback there. As always, we love to include your thoughts and critiques in our book club discussion episodes whenever possible. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Bubble. Thank you once again to Susan Lee for joining us. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see y'all next time on Books and Bubble. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Bubble. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandbubble and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandbubble.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Bubble and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandbubble.com. Books and Bubble is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.